Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Israeli reactions to the P5+1 deal with Iran and speak first with a liberal analyst and then a conservative former advisor to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Jerusalem-based historian and journalist Gershom Gorenberg joins us to provide a critique of the Prime Minister's condemnation of the agreement, which Netanyahu calls an historic mistake. And we will also discuss Gershom Gorenberg's article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement Anxiety Disorder. Then we will speak with Dr. Joseph Olmert, the former director of the Government Press Office and advisor to former Prime Minister Shamir. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Iranian Agreement, A Possible Realignment of Middle East Politics. And we will discuss Israelis' concerns that the more moderate face of the new leader, Rouhani, disguises the hardline reality of the Supreme Leader's anti-Israeli views that echo the extreme positions of the former Iranian President Ahmadinejad. Then finally, we'll examine a new report in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds U.S. emissions of the potent global warming gas methane are 50% higher than EPA government estimates. The co-author of the study, Anna Michalak, a professor at Stanford University School of Earth Sciences, joins us to discuss the increased amount of methane that is 21 times worse than CO2 coming from agriculture and oil and gas production that does not include recent data from fracking and other new drilling. And joining us now from Israel is Gershom Gorenberg, a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and his books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his latest book is The Unmaking of Israel. He has an article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement Anxiety Disorder. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gershom Gorenberg.
Glad to be here.
And your article starts out with the paradox of kind of institutional paranoia that the state of Israel encourages, in a sense, by having everybody have a gas mask ready, not as if there haven't been any incidents in the past and threats, but apparently the defense ministry now is recommending that civilians don't really need them because the Russians and the Americans, with their agreement with Syria, have succeeded in removing Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. So the prospect of Syrian missiles raining down on Israel have gone away. But you point out...
I would moderate that a little bit. Right. First of all, the reason for having the gas masks, I think, was based on originally on a realistic assessment. There was a danger, and it was a practical and low emotion response to a real problem. It was, you know, like having a fire department or something like that. But the major threat of chemical weapons was from Syria. The threat hasn't disappeared, but the evaluation is that it is being successfully and steadily reduced. And under those circumstances, this stopped being a priority for the defense establishment. In that sense, the threat of an attack at the end of the summer from the United States succeeded in pushing Syria and its patron Russia into an agreement to destroy the Syrian chemical weapons without ever having to fight. And besides all the other advantages of that situation, it has also improved security for Israel and for the normal Israeli going about his or her daily business.
Well, I guess, though, the point of bringing this up, and as you do in your article, is that when Obama decided not to attack Iran, and there was a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation that following the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, there was an expectation, because they had crossed the red line that Obama had drawn, that there would be a military strike. And when Obama decided against it and took the diplomatic track, there's no question that Prime Minister Netanyahu could barely conceal his contempt for it. Well, we know he doesn't like Obama to begin with, but there was
no lost love there.
Yes, but it was pretty clear that he felt
that Obama was displaying American weakness. In fact, he made it pretty clear in a speech at the time. So that's, I guess, the real point here. You've got somebody that doesn't seem to understand the value of diplomacy and seems to be completely wedded to military options and is swaggering about ready to go to war. And I would have thought that the Israelis would be kind of war-weary. So why is this man your leader?
Well, first of all, as I wrote in the article, I think that Netanyahu's fear, panicked reaction to agreements is based on a deep sense on his part that agreements fail, that agreements are deception, that they only strengthen your enemy, that the big powers sell you out. This is, as I see it, based on the traumatic experiences of Jews and of Israelis. Not everybody responds to Trump in the same way, but he's not the only one who responds that way. And so very often a leader's feelings, whether they be hopes or fears, resonate with a part of the population, and that gains the person votes. Second of all, Netanyahu is in power at the moment, in large part not because of his own popularity, but because of the failure of the Israeli opposition to unite and run a better campaign last year during the elections. Netanyahu lost a lot of his strength in parliament in the elections, but there was no united opposition that took advantage of that situation. And he is using his, shall we say, bully pulpit as prime minister to insist on the idea that that any agreement with Iran is insufficient. He doesn't put it that way, of course. He says that an agreement could be sufficient if it led to a total dismantlement of every aspect of Iran's nuclear program. But since an agreement of that sort isn't in the offing, basically what he's saying is that no agreement is sufficient. And he's been very public about that. He was public about not appreciating the advantages of the agreement on Syrian chemical arms, and he's been only more strident about the agreement with Iran.
Well, of course, there is historical justification for Israelis and Jews in general to be skeptical of the great powers, given the history of Munich, the appeasement of Hitler, and, of course, the British shutting the doors on Palestine to Jews in 1939. And there's no question that Israel is very skeptical of the United Nations. But the P5 plus one is the permanent five with Germany. These are the world powers. This agreement wasn't just with the Americans, who clearly Netanyahu doesn't trust. They're effectively with the world. Kerry's gone out of his way to say we're not stupid. In fact, he got frustrated on Israeli television and basically was talking about the Palestinian issue and said something to the effect that, do you want a third intifada? And isn't that at the heart of what's going on here, that Netanyahu is so wedded to the narrative over Iran because it serves to distract from the Palestinian issue that isn't going away, but somehow the Israeli right, well, you tell me, what is the Israeli right's plan here? What is their end game? As much as they clearly don't want to seriously negotiate with the Palestinians, what's the alternative?
Well, first of all, I would say regarding Netanyahu, I can't enter his mind and figure out whether this is a deliberate ploy, a cynical ploy to take attention off of the Palestinian issue, or whether he deeply believes that the only or the central problem that should be addressed is Iran, or possibly politically a combination of both of those things. But he has certainly tried to focus as much attention on the Iran issue as possible, and that has distracted from dealing with the Palestinian issue. The question of the right's end plan is really, it's a big question. I mean, I've been talking, interviewing people on the Israeli right for 30 years. There's many possibilities suggested. None of them are realistic. And In the end, the ultimate answer is the status quo is better for us than any of the alternatives that have been offered. So we're just going to have to hang on and, until everybody else is exhausted and puts up with the situation. I personally think that that's an incredibly unrealistic approach, but there really isn't an end plan. The end plan is this is the best we can do, so we're just going to keep doing it.
So, Gershom Gorenberg, excuse me. Again, I'm speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who is in Israel. He's a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and his books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his latest book is The Unmaking of Israel. He has an article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement, Anxiety Disorder. So what's happening now, Gershom, here is that the Congress seems to be gearing up to try and scuttle this deal, or at least those supporters of the Israeli right in terms of APAC, the Israeli lobby, which seems to have basically it started out with a lot of traction amongst Democrats, and it probably still has. In fact, there are a lot of Democrats lining up now to oppose this deal, but most of the more strident and frankly idiotic remarks are coming from Republican senators and from the Republican spin machine through Fox News, or the Republican Pravda through Fox News, where they're basically talking about Obama's somehow got the mullahs to make this deal to distract Americans from the botched launch of Obamacare.
Conspiracy theories know no end.
But the question is, I mean, what is this display of fealty on the part of the American Congress, the senators and the House, on both parties to right-wing Israeli politics? Whatever happened to J Street? I mean, we have this paradox here where something like 75% of American Jews who support Israel are on the liberal side and support the peace plan and support, the Obama administration, but somehow that's not reflected in the Congress.
Well, I would say several things here very quickly. One is I would advise all of those elected representatives to pay more attention to what Israeli analysts, professional analysts, ex-generals, and so forth have been saying about this agreement, which is either much more softly critical to cautiously supportive and completely on a different tone than Netanyahu has been speaking. For instance, the nuclear expert, Professor Uzi Evan, today pointed out that the biggest risk from Iran was from production of plutonium. That's the only kind of nuclear weapon that can be mounted on a missile, and therefore stalling the Iranian reactor that would have produced plutonium is a huge success for this diplomatic path. The second thing is the mood coming out from Washington, at least as I can read it, is already shifting in the sense that instead of there being support for immediate sanctions, there's talk of more talk in actual legislative terms of sanctions if this six-month agreement doesn't work out, which shows a retreat. And the third thing is, I really think that it's fascinating in this context, is that in a situation where there was a clear American strategic interest facing off with APAC and other lobbying groups, their power it seems to have been much less than is commonly assumed. That is to say, it is much easier for elected officials to go along with what the lobby wants when there's no good, clear policy option. And so deciding between bad options, okay, you have this pressure from a lobby in one direction. In this case, the president saw a clear opening for a strategic improvement of the American situation. And while nobody can make a prediction of what's going to happen in Congress, I suspect that this whole situation is going to reveal the limits of AIPAC's power. And I think it's very important to pay attention to that, because there is a tendency to only notice their successes. And the irony of that situation is they advertise their successes in order to get support. Constantly attributing to the lobby more power than it actually has, it is actually very helpful to it. And this situation may well produce a proof of the limits of that lobby's power.
Well, when you talk, though, about, and you mentioned security figures in Israel, military and defense analysts, saying that the agreement is in Israel's interest, you're referring to the Arak heavy water reactor, which is the same kind of reactor that the Israelis have at Dimona. But the difference between Israel and Iran in the nuclear portfolio is profound and extraordinary. Israel has about 200 deliverable nuclear weapons. Iran has none. And Iran, while the Arak reactor is not complete, there is no capability on the part of the Iranians to reprocess the plutonium that would come out of these spent fuel rods, whereas Israel...
Well, one of the aspects of the agreement is to freeze development of that potential. That's part of the whole
right.
list of things that freezes the plutonium path on the Iranian on the part of the Iranians. It doesn't
right.
end it, but it freezes it for the 6-month interim agreement and opens the opportunity to roll it back in a final agreement or in a permanent agreement.
Right, but the reactor is definitely being built, but there's no evidence, as far as I know, that they have reprocessing for plutonium fuel rods.
No, the issue is developing that potential, and as I said, the one point in the agreement is freezing that development. So that stopping development at this point of the Arak reactor is essentially putting the plutonium program at a dead stop for the period of the agreement. And since that's the most potentially dangerous part of the Iranian program, that's quite an achievement for diplomacy.
So just in closing then, Gershom Gorenberg, as much as the world is hailing this agreement as an historic agreement, and of course Netanyahu is saying it's a historic mistake, but nevertheless there is a sense that the new President Rouhani is a breath of fresh air. The Supreme Leader still is saying incredibly hostile and poisonous anti-Israel statements, which we're all familiar with. And so from an Israeli point of view, and we're going to be talking to a right-wing Israeli coming up who's to be the press spokesperson for Yitzhak Shamir, but from your point of view as a liberal, I guess, or a dove, I don't know how you want to be labeled, Gershom, but what is, in terms of what threatens your country, is the rhetoric from the familiar, you know, death, well, they're not going to be saying death to America anymore, apparently, or at least they're going to tone that down, but they still continue to say death to Israel and wipe Israel off the map. On the other hand, you have the Saudis, who appear to be in a kind of tacit alliance with Israel on many respects. They both support the military government in Egypt, for example. The Saudis are unleashing these incredibly toxic jihadis in Syria, and they've unleashed the Taliban and al-Qaeda and you name it around the world. So there's a potential in this agreement to shift away from Saudi Arabia, if you will, in this proxy war going on in the Middle East, towards Iran. And a lot of analysts think in the long run we're better off dealing with Iran than Saudi Arabia, because this regime will continue to export its radical elements, and all it cares about is staying in power.
Look, this is, even for somebody who is a dove and is on the left side of Israeli politics being realistic, this is not a nice neighborhood, and it's not a good idea to romanticize the qualities of any of the players. If there is a possibility of shifting Iran through diplomacy to be less dangerous, that's a net gain for Israeli security. If you look at what's going on in the debate in Israel at this moment, you will also see a very large amount of criticism of the government, and particularly of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for causing a crisis in relations with the United States and Europe, given that those alliances are a strategic asset, perhaps the most important strategic asset that Israel has. So when you're looking at Netanyahu's international statement, there's a tendency in the international press to pay most attention to the leader of a country, and even in a democracy, to act as if that leader speaks for the entire people. Well, George W. Bush didn't speak for you. And Netanyahu doesn't speak for everybody in Israel. And in fact, he's taking considerable criticism, which you probably won't find from hear from your next interviewee, for endangering the relationship with Israel's allies.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Israel, Gershom Gorenberg.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who's a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and he blogs at southjerusalem.com. His books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967-77, and The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. His latest book is The Unmaking of Israel, and he has an article at The American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement, Anxiety, Disorder. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Dr. Joseph Olmert, the former government press advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Joseph Olmert, who is a Middle East scholar, former peace negotiator, political insider, journalist, author, public speaker, and professor at the University of South Carolina. As director of the government press office and advisor to then-Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir during the first Gulf War and the International Peace Conference in Madrid, he secured press relations for Israel with the Soviet Union and China and represented the Prime Minister in numerous conferences and appearances in the United States, Great Britain, Australia, China, Russia, Japan, and South Africa, among others. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Iranian Agreement, A Possible Realignment of Middle East Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Joseph Olmert.
It's my pleasure.
And when you say there's a possible realignment of the Middle East politics, what does that mean, particularly in terms of this sort of proxy war going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Syria and in generally the division within the Middle East, over the Sunni-Shia divide, for the want of a better description?
Well, you know, something very interesting is happening these days in the Middle East, all due to the changes, twists and turns of American policy, that finally, after all those years, a lot of the Arab states and Israel are on one side of the political fence with regard to a crucial issue, and America is on the other side of it. So that's interesting in itself. But look, when you hear the reactions in Saudi Arabia and in other countries regarding the Iran deal, and you hear the reactions in Israel, you can see an interest. Now, how will it develop, or will it develop, will it evolve into something more concrete? That I don't know. But I raise the possibility in this piece that it might, you know. In the end of the day, when you talk about the Middle East, you need to get away from the equation that it is only about the Arab-Israeli conflict, so always automatically Israelis are on one side, the Arabs are on another side. Now, for a change, you see a situation whereby the Israelis and many Arabs are on one side of the fence. That is an interesting and potentially very positive development.
Well, it's clear that Israel and Saudi Arabia are on the same page, if you will, vis-a-vis the military government now in Egypt. The Saudis objected to the Obama support for the fall of Mubarak, and now it seems that both Israel and Saudi Arabia are happy to see this government in place. And, you know, whether or not it lasts, and we don't know. So already you have seemed to have an alliance, if you will, on that that regard.
I don't know if there is an alliance, but there is, again, a joint interest here. And it's something that is not being manipulated behind the scenes or so. It's not like a conspiracy theory of any kind. That's what the situation in the Middle East offers us. But look, and in the case of Egypt, also, the U.S. has made a very interesting change in the last few days. All of a sudden, Secretary Kerry declared that it's a legitimate regime, the military regime there, as opposed to what was the position before. So at least on this one, the Americans are putting themselves on one side with most of their allies in the Middle East, but by the way, not with Turkey. As you know, I mean, the Egyptians broke the diplomatic relations with Turkey, which is, by the way, a very major development, but that's another story.
Well, but let's follow this through, though, to Syria. Now, surely Israel and Saudi Arabia are not on the same page in Syria. I find it hard to believe that the West has, in effect, because of its feckless response, has allowed the Saudi Arabians to essentially arm the radical regimes. And I cannot understand that anybody would want Syria to end up as a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean.
So, it is already kind of Somalia, whether we like it or not. And by the way, it's not the fault of the Saudis. They are contributing to it, of course, because they are the main backers of some of the Islamic groups, but also, I mean, the more moderate ones. But look, Syria basically today is practically divided into an Alawite autonomous region, basically parts of Damascus and Aleppo are still under the control of the regime. Large parts of the Sunni interland are not. The Druze area in the south and the Kurdish area in the north are basically autonomous, self-ruled. So this is what it is. I mean, it's not the making of the Saudis. It's not the making of the Israelis. It's not the making of anyone else from the outside. It's the making of the Syrian people, which is aggravated, that's true, by foreign intervention. By the way, a Saudi newspaper just published very recently a long list of the names of all the Iraqi Shia militias which fight in Syria alongside the Assad regime, of course, the Iranians, and then there are those who support Saudi Arabia, or are supported by Saudi Arabia. So all this is happening, and, you know, we need to understand something about the Middle East. This is that if we think that everything is caused in all those countries by foreign intervention, it's a kind of patronizing approach to all these people. Because in the end of the day, look, the Syrian people, the majority of them, the Sunnis, they don't want Bashar Assad because that's a minoritarian regime. The Saudis exploited it. Fair enough. That's very true. They didn't create the situation in the first place. I will remind you that King Abdullah went the distance of even being in Damascus at one point in time in 2009, I believe it was. Then they met in Beirut as well. So everything seemed to be rosy and cozy, so to speak. But then came the civil war in Syria, which was not the making of any foreign country, but the making of the Syrian people, being manipulated now and aggravated by foreign interference. That's true.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Almer, who is a Middle East scholar, former peace negotiator, political insider, journalist, author, public speaker, and professor at the University of South Carolina, as director of the Government Press Office and advisor to then-Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir during the first Gulf War and the International Peace Conference in Madrid. He secured press relations for Israel with the Soviet Union and China. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, "The Iranian Agreement, A Possible Realignment of Middle East Politics." So what then do you make of Prime Minister Netanyahu's notion that this agreement, which most of the capitals around the world are celebrating and hailing as an historic agreement, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is the odd man out, is saying it's a historic mistake?
Well, you know, to be an odd man out is not necessarily as bad thing. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Time will tell, you know, whether it's historic or not. We shall live to wait and see. Hopefully it is historic and it is positive, so it will be great. But I'm not sure about it. Prime Minister Netanyahu would like to put himself in the shoes of Winston Churchill. He is this great hero. I'm not sure that he fits the shoes of Winston Churchill, but that's another story. Look, this is an agreement. The agreement was there, and I wrote about the agreement before it was achieved and afterwards. And my point has always been that Israel should not be seen as if Israel objects to the very idea that there should be an agreement. Because every diplomatic progress that will make, that will achieve the positive result is better than anything else, any other option. The question really is a question of verification. And I will remind you and your many listeners, I'm sure you have many, that in 1994, the U.S. did achieve an agreement along similar lines with North Korea. Remember, under Clinton, with Madeleine Albright at that time and all that. And you know what happened? There was no verification process in place, or not effective one, and North Korea is that much closer now to the atomic bomb than they were in 1994. So, you know, opposition, therefore, to the agreement between Iran and the powers can be based on some realities. They don't need necessarily to imply all kinds of apocalyptic scenarios. And in this score, I'm not sharing, you know, the PR line or the diplomatic line of Prime Minister Netanyahu. But the basic point here is the agreement. Let's see how it can be verified. You know, verification is the key to everything.
Well, of course, the agreement that it's being compared to is not the North Korean agreement, but Nixon's trip to Mao's China.
Okay, so those who make this comparison to Nixon are making a mistake, because here we talk about the particular, the same situation, the same type of agreement. Now, if this agreement would lead to a breakthrough of diplomatic proportions between the U.S. and Iran, that's something else. That remains to be seen. But in the meantime, we talk about an agreement about a nuclear program in Iran compared with an agreement about a nuclear program in North Korea. So, you know, I may take issue here with those who made this comparison to China. It's not really the right comparison. It's not a relevant comparison. But let me say again, look, Israeli government needs to be seen as if they support the idea that there should be a diplomatic agreement. I agree with you on that. They should be focusing their opposition to particular parts of the agreement, which they can claim with conviction are not sufficient enough in terms of providing the machinery of verification. All this remains to be done by the Israelis, and hopefully it will be done by them, because I understand that there is going to be a meeting in Washington between two teams, one of the American administration and one of the Israeli government, to try and hammer out all the differences between the two countries. So that remains to be seen, and hopefully they will come to an understanding.
And Dr. Joseph Olmert, critics of Netanyahu in Israel that I've spoken to say that one of the reasons he keeps talking about Iran all the time is, as long as he's talking about Iran, he doesn't have to talk about the Palestinian situation. So if that is true, then would that mean that there'll be more focus on trying to have a real agreement with the Palestinians?
Well, look, the connection between the two issues is there. I mean, whether it is that connection that you describe on the part of some of those who don't like Netanyahu. By the way, I'm not exactly one of his greatest supporters. If I am one of his greatest supporters, he would like to have better supporters than me. But, well, you know, all I can tell you is that if the Netanyahu government will be able to convince the Israeli public that the agreement with Iran is dangerous to Israel's security, you can forget about progress with the Palestinians, because no Israeli government will take the risk of making concessions to the Palestinians, which may be taken to be crucial to Israeli security at a time when they still feel the Iranian threat is hanging over their heads. So that's the connection here. Now, of course, we talk about politicians and about politics. To tell you that the Netanyahu government are enthusiastic about the Palestinian talks, no, they are not. They are definitely not. To tell you that other Israeli parties are terribly enthusiastic about that, not at all either. You know, maybe the Meretz party and elements in the Labor Party, but there is no real pressure in Israel right now on the Netanyahu government to move dramatically ahead with the Palestinians. And this is for all kinds of other reasons, not necessarily connected only with the Iranian negotiations. So it's a little bit more complicated there, you know.
Well, but when you say that Israel couldn't make a deal with the Palestinians as long as...
I didn't say that.
No, well, that there were security considerations in terms of not making a deal, because Israel didn't want to be vulnerable at a time when there was outside pressure. Now, I don't know whether you've seen this documentary where all the former heads of the Mossad and the Shin Bet...
Not all of them, some of them.
Well, an awful lot. And you have to admit the preponderance is pretty convincing, at least.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was reviewing this documentary in a public meeting here in Columbia, South Carolina, and, you know, I am aware of all the gatekeepers. Look.
Yeah, right. So if they're saying the opposite. They're saying that a deal with Palestinians is first and foremost in Israel's security interest.
they said it without any regard to the Iranian situation. If you recall, the word Iran was not even mentioned in this documentary. So you asked me about the connection between the two tracks, the Iranian situation and the Palestinian situation. Mm-hmm. So again, your example is not necessarily relevant, but I don't take issue with you. There are many people in Israel who think that Israel should do more concessions to the Palestinians. That's true. What I said was not necessarily what I personally believe in. What I said to you is that there is no real pressure on the Netanyahu government now with regard to the Palestinian talks. There is no real pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and by the way, if there is pressure on Netanyahu, it comes mostly from the right wing of the Likud party and those who are right of Likud, which is not exactly the type of positive pressure that one might expect to see. That's what I said, you know, but true enough, there are all kinds of people who think that there should be more concern to the Palestinians, but you'll be surprised to hear that even former heads of the security services are not necessarily the most convincing people in Israel. There are some other people as well who think otherwise.
Sure. Well, that's what Henry Kissinger said about Israel, didn't he? That Israel doesn't have a foreign policy, they have domestic politics.
What do you think what they say about America now, that they signed the agreement in Geneva because of Obamacare, you know? So.
Well, but now, do you seriously believe that?
I don't seriously believe that. And as you recall my article, I mentioned that in a somewhat cynical way.
Right.
I don't know. Look, what does it mean if I believe that or not? If the Saudis believe that and some people in Israel believe that, that's what matters. I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think so. But I think there's something else happening, by the way.
What is it?
That I wrote about. It's what I would call neo-isolationism, which is, okay, look, you are Americans, you will decide the future course of your country. I mean, who we are to tell you what to do? I mean, it's only Americans tell other people what to do. But look, there is neo-isolationism in America as a result of two failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Everybody can understand it. I'm not debating it. I'm just pinpointing to something which is happening. And that may affect the desire to be seen as if we, America, are quickly concluding all kinds of outstanding world issues, and therefore we have more time to deal with our own issues inside the U.S. That's a legitimate concern on the part of the American administration, American people. Who am I to debate it? But that, I believe, exists. Whether it is Obamacare or not, no, I don't think so, Obamacare and all that. But look, Congress is not so supportive of the president now on other issues, and it may also prove to be not supportive of him with regard to the sanctions on Iran. That's another issue.
Well, that's a real possibility, isn't it? It may actually end up with the president having to invoke a veto if in December, early December, the House and Senate are going to take up more sanction bills.
Yeah, well, that could happen. I don't believe it's going to happen. My personal take on it is that the Congress will do something else, which will be a little bit more sophisticated, if I may say so. And this is to enact a new set of potential sanctions, but not to implement them and to keep them like as a sword over the heads of the administration in terms of, checking the process of verification of the agreement. That, I believe, Congress will do. If I was to give any advice to anyone, who am I to do that, I would say, hey, look, wait, you know, let it work. Let's see. There was an agreement signed. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to decide already 3 days afterward that this is not going at all to work. This is not, by the way, what I wrote in this article that you quoted. All I said in this article was that it's all about verification. Let's see what happens. But the concerns are there. They are very viable and they are reasonable, judged by past experiences.
Well, just
by the way, let me make another point.
Sure, go ahead.
Very significant. If you are an Israeli, a Jewish person, or just normal, normative, a liberal-minded person in this world, what do you say when you hear the supreme leader of Iran talks about the Jews the way he did a few days ago, like it was Nazi Germany again? This is really something that nobody almost paid attention to outside of Israel. But look, all those who really care about the quality and the significance of international relations should pay attention to something like that. Who really rules Iran, Rouhani or the Supreme Leader? The Supreme Leader said what he said about the Jews just a few days ago. It's terrible.
Well, it is a terrible regime, and we saw what happened when the Iranian people tried to rise up against it. But that's not to say that there aren't a lot of people in Iran who want better relations.
Well, that's true. I agree with you on that. Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's why I'm asking the question, what is the real Iran?
Right.
I leave it with a question mark.
Sure. Well, let me leave you with a question here, because we're running out of time, but I'm curious to know about...
I need to go to another class here at the university. Some students are waiting for me.
Okay, but it'd be very quickly, the concerns that I understand the Israelis have are about the Arak reactor. That's a heavy water reactor similar to the one at Dimona that produced the Israeli arsenal. Yeah. But my understanding is that they've frozen this in this agreement. But even if you could get the plutonium out of the rods in this reactor, you have to reprocess the plutonium into bomb-grade plutonium, and that's a huge deal. And my understanding is the Iranians don't even have that. And
I'm very bad at chemistry. I must be honest with you. Not that I'm running out of this interview, but, you know, if you ask me such a technically loaded question, I don't know what the answer is, and I would not venture to tell you what I'm not an expert on.
Right.
I don't know if I'm an expert on any other thing, but not on this one.
Okay.
But,
let
me end up on a more positive note. Look, the president called the prime minister, Obama called Netanyahu, Mr. Obama called Mr. Netanyahu, and they agreed that there should be an ongoing dialogue between our two countries with regard to what are the implications of the agreement in terms of verification and so on and so forth. I really very much hope that they will come to some kind of common denominator, some kind of a formula that would ease up the pressures and tensions in Israel. These pressures and tensions are genuine. Are very genuine and connected also to the statement by the Supreme Leader. Anytime when Israeli people listen to a statement like that, they got nervous and for good reason. We all remember what happened 70 years ago. And that's not something to be used lightly. But it has to be mentioned as well as part of the overall equation.
Well, Dr. Joseph Elmer, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Joseph Elmer, who's a Middle East scholar, former peace negotiator, political insider, journalist, author, public speaker, and professor at the University of South Carolina, a director of the government press officer and advisor to then-Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir during the first Gulf War and the International Peace Conference in Madrid. He secured press relations for Israel with the Soviet Union and China and represented the Prime Minister in numerous conferences and appearances in the United States, Great Britain, Australia, China, Russia, Japan, and South Africa, among others. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Iranian Agreement, A Possible Realignment of Middle East Politics. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the co-author of a new study that finds U.S. emissions of the potent global warming gas methane are 50% higher than EPA government estimates. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anna Michalak, who is a professor of Stanford University School of Earth Sciences and a researcher with the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institute for Science. She is a co-author of the new study just published by Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds U.S. methane emissions 50% higher than government estimates. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anna Michalak.
Thank you for having me.
And my understanding is that the United States is spewing about 50% more methane than the federal government, the EPA, has estimated. And most of it is coming from just three states, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas.
You're correct in the sense that our estimates are that the total emissions are about 50% higher than the EPA inventory suggests. About a quarter of those emissions are coming from the three states that you mentioned, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and that is the region for which, relatively speaking, we're seeing a much higher number compared to what some other inventories have suggested. I do have to add a little bit of a caveat in the sense that the EPA itself only provides national total numbers. And so when we're making regional comparisons, we're actually comparing to a second inventory called the Edgar Inventory, which is an international inventory.
So, but in order to do this study and come up with these figures, apparently you've taken 13,000 measurements from airplane flights and tall towers, but this was done in 2008, and my understanding is that new measurements will be repeated in I thought they'd been repeated in 2012, but they don't include much of the impact of fracking. So just clarify that, if you will.
So the study that we just published covers our estimates of emissions for the U.S. as a whole for 2007 and 2008. The reason covers those years is because of the wealth of data, both aircraft data and tall tower data, as you mentioned, that we have available for those 2 years. They do come before the recent boom in shale gas production and just an increase in natural gas production in general. So in addition to what they tell us about those two particular years, they really offer a baseline for what emissions were before this recent growth in natural gas production.
Well, of course, this is a very key piece of information to find out, surely, because the idea of switching to natural gas and away from coal is being justified on the basis of the simple fact that natural gas, I think, produces about 50% less CO2 than coal. But if it turns out that in order to get this natural gas, either fissures are happening at the wellheads or in various other places because of the hydraulic fracturing and there's seepage, since methane is, 21 times more potent a global warming gas than CO2, this would make the whole fracking boom a wash, would it not?
Our study doesn't address specifically what these numbers mean for the trade-off between different types of energy sources. But let me tell you a little bit more about what the study does say that speaks to your question, at least to the extent that we can extrapolate from the results in our work. And so the methods that we use are based on these atmospheric measurements that you mentioned earlier. And what these measurements are very strong at is giving us a number on what are the total emissions from the U.S. and what are the total emissions from certain specific regions in the U.S. To some extent, we can drill down at a high level to different economic sectors. So, for example, emissions associated with animal husbandry, emissions associated with oil and gas production and refining. But we are not drilling down to the level of what are emissions from, for example, fracking, what are emissions from, expansions of specific types of technologies. Really, what I would say the main contribution of our work is it provides complement to the inventory-based approach that the EPA is using. In the inventories, what the EPA does is essentially make a laundry list of all the different types of emissions that we're aware of and use data that are available to try to quantify those individual sources. At the end, you can add up all of these individual line items, but as you can imagine, the uncertainty compounds as you are adding up all of these individual numbers. What our study shows is what that total ought to be, and the results really show that the total that we see from the atmosphere does not match the sum of the parts in the inventories. And so really what the study provides is a call to action to drill back into those inventories to understand better what types of emissions might have been underestimated, what types of emissions might be missing. And once we can reconcile what the inventories are telling us from that line item perspective with the total that we see in the atmosphere, at that point, one can have intelligent discussions about the points that you've brought up, such as what does this mean for the overall climate impact of one energy source versus another. But at this point, really what our study is saying is that the total does not equal the sum of the parts, and we need to resolve that discrepancy if we are going to move forward.
And again, I'm speaking with Anna Michalak, who is a professor at Stanford University School of Earth Sciences and a researcher with the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science. She is the co-author of a new study just published by Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds U.S. methane emissions 50% higher than government estimates. So, but at this point, it would seem that the headline here is that the United States is spewing 50% more methane than the EPA had estimated. And this is only going to 2008 before the fracking boom began. I think one can assume that the next measurements that you come up with are likely to be worse, are they not?
So one quick point of clarification. The EPA estimates that we're comparing to are the latest estimates in the sense that they were released this year, but we are comparing apples to apples in the sense that we're comparing EPA's estimate for 2008 with our own estimates for 2008. So those numbers are directly comparable. In terms of where we expect emissions to have gone between 2008 and today, it depends a little bit on your perspective on the problem. From one perspective, it's undeniably true that overall natural gas production has increased, that the production of shale gas has increased. But on the other hand, some might argue that the technology has improved substantially as well, so that per unit gas produced, the emissions may have decreased substantially. And so you would have one trend pushing emissions up, in other words, more gas production, and you might have another trend pushing emissions down if the technology has indeed improved substantially over that time period. And so, you know, in the reporting on this paper, individual parties have very much pushed for emphasizing one or the other of those trends. But from a scientific standpoint, the only honest thing to do is to actually repeat the study and see what we see in these most recent years, and again reconcile that with the line items that we have within the inventories.
So, Anna Michalak, again, a professor at Stanford University School of Earth Sciences and a researcher with the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science. She's the co-author of this new study that finds that previous estimates by the EPA of the amount of methane spewing into the atmosphere are 50% lower than the findings in this new study that we're talking about here. And in terms of one of the aspects of the study, which I think most people think it's kind of amusing. It's a sort of joke that you would see on late night television about cows' flatulence and burping. But the truth of the matter is that what your studies found is that cows spewing twice as much methane than previously thought. Is that right?
That is correct, and that is our estimate. And just to be clear, it's not just flatulence and burping, but also manure management is actually a very large methane source that comes from animal husbandry and cows in particular. But yes, so our study indicates that the emissions associated with what we call ruminants, so a whole class of animals that cows among them being the chief type within the U.S., are emitting about twice as much methane as inventories suggest. And I think this is actually a perfect example of the challenges associated with this inventory-based approach. You can imagine that within the EPA inventory, the number of cows can be tracked to a relatively high level of accuracy, but then one needs to apply some type of multiplicative factor to translate that number of animals into total emissions, and there's a certain uncertainty associated with that. Whereas from the atmospheric perspective, what we're actually seeing is the net impact of all of that economic sector. And so we have a pretty strong constraint on what the total emissions may indeed be.
But what would their contribution be in the overall spectrum of methane emissions?
At the national level, I would actually have to dig back out to give you a precise percentage. Mm-hmm. But
a ballpark would do, though, just to get an idea of how, where.
So let me give you this number. Globally, methane emissions associated with all kinds of agricultural production are about half of total emissions globally. So we're talking about a very large number.
And this is half of roughly half of what's being produced. What then, if we realize at the end of the day how important and detrimental methane is in terms of the adding to global warming, what do we do about all those cows? Doesn't this raise some very challenging questions?
It does, and it's been interesting to see some of the commentary on the news stories coming out, and a lot of advocates for veganism, for example, making a point about eating lower down on the food chain. But I think it is important to recognize that human beings are contributing to greenhouse gas emissions through a whole host of activities, so not just the types of things that we tend to think of, like driving cars and flying planes and heating our homes, but really through the full spectrum of economic activities that contribute to sustaining our lifestyle. And there's no doubt that on a global level, the increased demand for animal protein is a huge driver of climate change in a variety of contexts, whether it's land use change, land use for agriculture, methane emissions, and a variety of other issues as well.
So just in the last minute, Anna Michalak, my understanding is that there's a sort of self-reinforcing aspect to global warming. As it gets worse, so does it exponentially release more methane, particularly with the Arctic tundra, when it releases all of the methane as it gets warmer. So is that a factor? Is that coming online yet, that kind of apocalyptic addition to this already fairly frightening problem?
Right. What you're referring to is a whole host of what we call positive feedback sense. In other words, mm-hmm. the worse things get. There is a lot of concern within the scientific community about the melting of Arctic permafrost, so the melting of soils that have historically been permanently frozen. And there are many ongoing studies looking at that problem. There hasn't been anything that could be called a massive change in those emissions as of yet, but it's one of those factors that could change very quickly could change by a large amount over a short period of time. And that is, of course, a factor that is separate from the types of sources that we looked at in this study, where we were looking only at the direct impacts of human activity rather than these more indirect impacts mediated through global warming, for example. But you're right that ultimately, if we want to understand the global methane budget and if we want to understand global climate change, we need to be looking at all of these different components, which gets back to the importance of understanding what the baseline is so that we can make informed decisions in the future.
Well, Anna Michalak, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Anna Michalak, who's a professor at Stanford University School of Earth Sciences and a researcher with the Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution for Science. She is the co-author of a new study just published by Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds U.S. methane emissions 50% higher than government estimates. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow.
Bye for now.